All right, Kiss Army, welcome to the Kiss FAQ podcast. Thank you for giving us your time today and letting us into your head. I hope we don't do any damage. This is a Kiss-related podcast by the board for the board. We hope that you enjoy. We'd love you to support this show. Please like, follow, and subscribe to us on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Your likes and subscription helps us to grow and attract interviews and content. So please retweet and share our posts. Your contributions are appreciated. Welcome to the Kiss FAQ podcast. Happy New Year to everyone watching live, tuning in later. We are back for, well, we're entering year number, what year number is it, 10 or 11? Because it's going to be 10th anniversary, which means we're going into our 11th year, I guess. We've been doing this shit a long time. Hope everyone had a great New Year's Eve. I was wrapped up in bed by like 8 o'clock.
Wow.
I don't stay up to midnight. Screw that. I get up at 4. So.
Oh, Lord.
I prefer the other end of the day to the nighttime because there's less people around. So, got Daniel joining us today, Marcus Almighty.
Greetings.
And I'm getting some serious Hello. Echo from someone's microphone.
Delay.
I think it's Daniel.
What? It's always Daniel.
No.
I want to thank everyone who's joining us live. Ronnie Parker, CMAC, welcome back. Sylvie, good to see you. Thank you for your video. Austin and G Chup so far. I'm sure others will trundle in and comment as we get going with today's topics. I do want to also mention we do have the 10th anniversary show coming up very soon. We've received some fantastic, absolutely amazing contributions from fans who've been watching the show or you know, following us for years, following us not for years. We would love more. We'd love to get content and comments from everyone who's interested in participating in that 10th anniversary show and celebrating, you know, hitting a milestone. It's not just about us. It's about you who've joined us on this journey as well. So if you'd like to, there's a phone number that you can leave a message. It actually worked. I had my first phone message, which was very cool. We can also do video sessions, or you can just record something on your iPhone. And Daniel, what sort of things would you love our fellow fans to be, you know, talking about in any comments that they submit for this episode?
Well, you mean for the 10th anniversary?
Yes.
What kind of comments? Well, probably
what would you love?
What I would love, well, your honest opinion, what the podcast has meant to you, how long you've been listening. Maybe favorite episode, favorite panelist. Oh, you don't have to pick
no.
a favorite. Ken would get all
Daniel.
The votes.
Mine's Daniel.
I guess keep it personal. Keep it close to the heart. Just speak your mind. That's always nice. I enjoyed the last time we did this. I think it was the 500th episode where we had some people, you know, phone in and send us some videos. Great material, great stuff. Sometimes you forget about all the people, you know, that there's quite a few listening to us. And so everything is welcome. Just come up with something original or personal.
Yeah, I'm curious, just to go around the panel quickly. I actually surprised myself this year with New Year's. I actually celebrated New Year's Eve by watching the Vancouver 1999 video. Which is, of course, the basis for what became the Millennium Concert, one of the worst KISS live recordings ever. but the live VHS from that night is actually very fun to watch and revisit. It was a really cool set. It was the first time that stuff like I Love It Loud, Lick It Up, and Heaven's on Fire came back to the set. The first time the originals lineup performed that stuff. So it was great to look back through that and actually hear it with a little bit of that muddiness of an audio recording.
Mm-hmm. I think my most vivid memory from that concert was that they completely messed up the, you know, the countdown for the New Year's Eve.
Oh, completely.
They
completely botched it. They had no way of really telling where it was. They got a little bit lost. They, you know, did a weird set sequence in order to get there on somewhat on time, and then left it to Paul to do the best he could. But he couldn't. I don't think he could see a reference to the countdown clock or a countdown, and it completely threw him off. He did the best he did. They did the best that they could. The audience celebrated. regardless. And Ace got to play 2,000 men minutes after, you know, he got his dream come true. So it was super fun going back to that, because that was just a little cluster of two shows. They did their return to Anchorage, Alaska, a couple of days later, and they have, I don't think they've been back since. And that was only the second time in their career. But it struck me as well that this was kind of the halfway point of their career. And that's the part that just really hit me in the guts, that what was coming into the end of the reunion was halfway done with Kistery and everything that's come since. It just does not seem to be a tale of two equal halves. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mark, how did you celebrate New Year's? Did you go into any music? Did you do anything Kissified? Or are you just too busy with your own music at the moment?
Actually, I did a little bit of both, to be honest with you. I did some watching. I watched, I think it was the Houston show. I watched that for some reason. I don't know why I picked that one particularly, but I watched that show and I enjoyed it very much. One of the things that I associate with Christmas, and you being an individual who originally resided in the UK will be appreciative of this, but I associate Doctor Who very strongly with Christmas time. And I watched a few of the Doctor Who Christmas specials. I've been on a John Pertwee sort of spin right now, watching quite a few of his episodes as well. So I've did a kind of a Doctor Who thing over the holidays as well. And it's interesting, though, just to go back to the anniversary, the 10th anniversary thing. One of the things I am hoping for is that I've been getting a lot of people now who've been, like, let's say, buying some of my CDs. One individual the other day just messaged me saying, "Hi, Mark, I bought your CD. I've been a longtime listener of the Kiss FAQ and watched the podcast for like 5 years now, but I never heard this guy come out and say it like at all. So I had no clue that he was a longtime watcher of the show." I'm hoping that more of that will happen. Maybe that some people will come out of the woodwork and say, you know, yeah, I've been watching for a long time too, because I just think that some people don't know that we don't know. It's almost like they assume that, oh, they must know I watch it. You know what I mean? But we don't, unless you come out and openly say that, you know, yeah, I've been a long time watcher. Only the people like who are within the chat or people who leave messages, we know for certain are people that watch on a daily basis. But I mean, I'm curious to hear of more people coming out, because I've had quite a few messages lately on my Bandcamp where they're saying, you know, I bought your latest album. By the way, I love the last episode of Kiss FAQ that you did. Great comments and stuff like that. So I hope that happens more often.
Yeah, very cool. Ken, how did you celebrate New Year's? Was there any music involved in it, or was it just...
I'm trying to think what I did. It's a blur, but no.
Lots of tequila, though.
No, not really. I didn't go crazy, but it was pretty quiet. I didn't really listen to much music, I don't think, on New Year's or anything. I checked out some of the TV stuff, seeing how other countries, you know, were celebrating around the world with their, you know, fireworks and all that kind of stuff. It's kind of interesting, some of the shows that they put on, whether it be drones or something else. It was interesting. I tried to watch a little bit of the, actually, if you're talking about music, some of those shows on TV at night where they had the, you know, they're playing or lip syncing or whatever. Not a lot of artists that I gravitate towards. It wasn't that, you know, that great. So yeah, this year was kind of a quiet, you know, a quieter one for me. And the last Kiss stuff I watched was really, at least on my TV, was that A&E. I talked about that, I think, last week, the biography. Otherwise, yeah, not a whole lot.
Well, here's another one for you to dig up as well. Atlanta 1996, because they used part of that broadcast. It was broadcast in Japan during the year, but they also used part of that for Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year. They piped that in that 1 year for New Year's. What, Mark?
Sorry, I just wanted to mention one thing really quickly before we move on. When New Year's happened, this is for you Kiss people out there, obviously. I'm sure a lot of you people know Dylan, the vinyl spinner. He's a huge Kiss guy. He just started a Kiss vinyl tag where he asked a bunch of different Kiss YouTube channels that do, you know, obviously KISS podcasts, to submit questions, and they did like a, I think it was 10 questions related to KISS in a vinyl tag. So if anybody out there is a vinyl collector and loves KISS, look up the vinyl spinner, Dylan, and you might be very interested in doing his vinyl tag.
Okay. Daniel, how did you celebrate New Year's? Was there any music involved, or were you face down in the snow?
Out in the darkness, in the snow. Yeah. Yeah. No. Well, what did I do? I had a pretty quiet evening. I barbecued with the family, and I've been binge watching one of my favorite American series for the third time with, you know, as your kids grow older, you can watch your favorite series with them as they reach the appropriate age. So I'm rewatching Breaking Bad for the third time.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I love that series. I need to wait 5 years between each time, because that allows me to forget enough in order to make it interesting again. So I guess I watched two or three episodes of Breaking Bad, and then in Sweden, we have a traditional thing going on just before midnight on TV, where they recite a classic poem. So I had to watch that for once again. It's just so such a classic thing. And they hire some you know, huge actor from Sweden, and he or she recites the poem, and everyone knows the poem. So
how long is the poem?
It's quite maybe 4 or 5 minutes long.
Wow. Oh, okay.
And it's all about leaving bad stuff behind, and
in
you
the
know,
past behind.
Going forward. Yeah.
Nice. Well, my New Year's resolution was to give up buying KISS shit, but the first stuff I bought this year has arrived. And someone had mentioned Off the Soundboard, so I picked up this Off the Soundboard ad from Japan, and it won't show up worth a damn.
There you go.
You can kind of see it, and that's for the Donington Off the Soundboard. It was just a very cool design.
I think that's one of the best shots from the reunion era of the band.
That was spectacular. Easily. They used it on some of the Japanese flyers back then, and it was in a lot of the press. So, yeah, New Year's resolution's already ruined, so there we go. Let's get into some of the board topics today, because we're just starting out the year loosey-goosey. You know, and there's been a few things. Let's start with the Central Park photo shoot timeline. I got to say, the person who put that together did an absolutely fantastic job of weaving it into a story. Whether or not it's accurate, it's a completely different matter, but they seem to put a lot of thought into logically how it would progress, the band putting on their makeup and getting to Central Park, doing the photo shoot. This is late 74, I believe. And all the places along the way that they would have stopped and done candid photos, right down to the stairwell, right into the park itself. It was really stunningly well done. And the first thing my first takeaway was, holy shit, New York City nowadays is just nothing but fucking scaffolding. And it's been like that all the times I've been there. You just cannot go anywhere without scaffolding. The whole place is just like, New York City is just scaffolding. Whereas in 1974, clearly they took a path that did not have scaffolding. Ken, did you get a chance to check it out? And what were your thoughts of it?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was really cool. I mean, it was a nice job they did on it. It's interesting, you know, because we have a lot of those pictures while they're out there. And then they're in that book, The One Kiss. What's the name of the book now? I can't remember. But I have it. I'm sure a lot of people have it. It has those black and white photos of them walking through, you know, New York and Central Park and all that, and interacting with people. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. I could see the you know, how he thought and put it together, you know, saying, well, they had to start here, and they went, you know, from A to B to get to here, and here they went to Central Park and went back. So kind of did it in that order, and showing, I always like stuff like that, showing what it was like then and then now, what it looks like, whether it still looks the same, you know, the same buildings are still there, or these little you know, corners, something that stands out as, oh yeah, they were here. They didn't take that picture. They were here. It's kind of like the Dress to Kill cover where people like to, you know, see that. You can do that with all these other, you know, locations that they shot a bunch of their pictures at within Central Park, and then, you know, walking through the city. So it's really, really cool to see where these photos were taken and how he put that this whole thing together. I guess he's been working on it many years to try to put it together. So it came out really good. And, you know, I'd love to see more like that, because it's really, you know, interesting and seeing where things are. If you're in the New York area, it'd be cool to, you know, go out to some of those places and based on his video. But really, really, really a job well done. It was cool.
Yeah, he went by one part just before they go into the park in the stairwell, and I drove by there in a taxi in December, and I was stuck in traffic. It was a hell of a – I should not have done the taxi from the airport. That was idiotic. I should have done Long Island Railroad. But I was having a nervous breakdown by that point in the vehicle, because I had a dinner, a reservation, and was meeting someone. And I was like, oh, that's the hotel. So it was really informative for me. Daniel, did you check it out?
Yeah. What it made me think of was Julian Gill's series, you know, that one he did about the songs of Kiss, the song series or whatever it's called.
Song stories, yeah.
Song stories, yeah. Because from time to time, Julian seems to be a bit disappointed that it didn't get more listeners on YouTube, that series. Mm. And I guess that's because he put a lot of effort into each episode. It's quite obvious that there are hours and hours put into those episodes. And I'd like people to discover them, because it's a great series. And I think one way of reintroducing this series the next time, you talked about doing another season in 2024. Yeah, we all know you'll do it, because if there's even
doing one episode right now.
Oh, you see, I think a great addition. Of course, it would take more of your precious time, but add some sort of video to the series. I think that would enhance it, and you would get a lot more listeners or watchers. And it can be you reading, telling the story like he did in that video, combined with photos, videos, stuff like that, to make it a bit more interesting for the eye, so to speak. I mean, a bit more visual. So that was the first thing I thought about. It was a great episode, and looking forward to more.
Yeah, I'm a target for copyright strikes. I don't want to strike and
yeah, but maybe warnings. You could find some way around it, adding video that, you know.
Do you know what, though?
Video, yep.
Honestly, I think that sometimes there has to be an element to a don't know what you got till it's gone to it. And I'm not talking about Cinderella. I'm talking about the fact that, you know, I think we sometimes take these things for granted. You know, Julian does a lot of this stuff, and he puts up a lot of things, and, you know, we're so used to getting all this quality stuff that, hey, people, if you don't support it and watch it, then it'll disappear, and then you'll be really upset about it. So support it. It's a good idea.
Now, I just checked that video, actually. When I watched it, it was like under 1,000 views. I was like, oh, shit, this guy is not getting a ton of views. It's not getting out there. I put the link in the chat, and I flashed it up on screen. Do check it out, because it's not going to take up your whole day like some of my shit.
No.
You know, it's not long-winded. It's very concise and well-narrated and a good flow. So,
but I also thought about, you know, Julian being one of the guys doing the Ace book. Maybe since you were talking about doing an episode on a song that Ace, that Ace played live in the early years. Maybe somehow you could release that in conjunction with the book and get Ace to sign off of it on it, and then you could use pictures and stuff like that.
Yeah, who knows what's going to be possible down the road. Mark, did you check it out? Thanks for showing that while we were talking, by the way.
Yes, I watched it, actually. I watched it twice. I watched it last night, and I watched it this morning just to refresh myself, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was well done. Being somebody who's gone to New York multiple times myself, some of those parts, I'm actually surprised that you know, I didn't recognize some of them because I do recognize a lot of the photos, but having gone to Central Park, it just went over my head that I was standing in some of these places, you know, but like you said, a lot of the things did change. Some of the signage that was there is not there anymore and it's been replaced with other things. But it was great that he showed out that nuclear fallout sign that was on the building there at the beginning. I thought that was great that that's still there and that he was able to show the correlation between the old photograph and the present. So that was, it was really well done, I thought.
Yeah, just that attention to detail was sickening. I was watching it. I had my notebook by me. I started writing down places in San Francisco. I'm like, I'm going to go get my camera. I'm going to go down to the Vagabond Inn and show where that was. And I can put up the memos and explain, you know, about the crew needing an advance from Neil Bogart to get out of San Francisco. And then, of course, they have these places in every Stockholm, you know, in Germany, in England, you know.
Toronto.
People can do these wherever you live, wherever KISS has journeyed. And I just wish more people would do that. But congratulations to War Paint Online Magazine for that. It was a very surprising thing just to have pop up. A nice surprise, a very pleasant one. So thank you for the entertainment. Let's move into one of the other topics. And This is going to be interesting. Bruce allegedly, I don't know where this has been posted, allegedly is going to write an autobiography. And I want to narrow it down and just ask a single question of each of us. And that's what is one topic or era that you would like him to discuss, no holds barred, for Bruce to take off the blinders, for him to take off the gloves? For him to really, you know, juice it up. Mark, start with you.
Well, as you guys all know, my favorite era is Asylum. But the one thing I'm more interested in, to be honest, being a musician and a musician who's, you know, been brought into, let's say, a slightly bigger band than I was in at the present time, what I'd love to hear him write in more detail is that whole his training, quote unquote, that he got with Gene and Paul about his stage performance. Because, you know, as they said before, that when he first came on, he said that he didn't move very much, he just kind of stood there and blah 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 blah. And of course, like you mentioned, that he said that, you know, he wanted to perform the songs, that was more important than him than this running around and spinning a guitar around his neck, right? So but I'd love for him to get the more detail about what they actually said to him. What did they make him do? I know he mentioned before that they made him unplug his guitar and just perform the moves without any music or without him actually physically playing it. I'd love to get into the more details, get into the weeds, so to speak, about what they made him do, what they made him rehearse and what they made him practice specifically, what they told him not to do. You know, like these are all things that I find fascinating, because every band sort of has a sort of image that they want to present when they go on stage. And I'm sure that he was probably made aware of, like, you know, you can't have your guitar, you know, up above, you know, shoulder level like the Beatles when you're playing, or you can't have this and that, you know, just little things like that where they wanted it to be more uniform transition. Because don't forget, he's yet again another guitar player. And if you can make the transition look seamless or as seamless as possible, the better for the band, right? So I'm really curious to hear about what he would say if he was able to do with great detail about that.
That's a very astute thing to want clarification or detail on. Nice. Daniel, for you.
Well, there's a lot of interesting stuff that he could talk about or write about, but I think I'm a bit interested of the studio work they did for Revenge, because it was such an improvement from the previous records. I would like to hear someone is doing something that sounds a lot in
Julian. This.
Okay.
I am Christmas fulfilling the role of Tommy Summers today.
He's opening Christmas presents still.
So I would like to hear his take on what did Bob Ezrin do in order to create such a great sound on the record. He could get a bit technical, but also how did Bob Ezrin treat Paul and Gene? How did he manage to, you know, keep them in check, so to speak, and not making them do a lot of decisions? But it's because it seems like Bob Ezrin was holding the reins for this record, and I think he was very important in order to get the great sound that they had on Revenge and the previous single God Gave Rock and Roll to You Too. So that would be pretty interesting to know how Bob Ezrin, you know, interacted with Paul and Gene. And because Bruce has said that he was tortured by Ezrin. What did Ezrin do in order to torture him? Because it obviously worked. It was one of his finest pieces of work ever, Bruce, I think, the solos on Revenge. So I'd like to hear more on that.
Actually, I can tell you one thing that he did that made that sound better. He hired a good engineer like Nick Bolas, because, you know, he's a producer. He probably did diddly squat as far as much of the sounds. But, you know, Nick Bolas and those guys, the guys who engineered it, probably were a very big reason why it sounded that good, in my opinion.
Engineers don't get the credit they're due.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even Bob in interviews has stressed the importance of the engineers in capturing the sound and a lot of the creativity that comes into the process of recording an album. All right, Ken, Bruce Kulick is at your service. What do you demand of Bruce?
Jeez. Here, get me some coffee. No.
I'm nearly out of coffee.
That's Thomas job.
Yeah, that's Thomas job. Jeez. You know what? Probably something is what was the, you know, the thoughts and the climate of the band during the period of the whole the convention scene, and when they were doing that, you know, what he thought of them, you know, doing that and why, and also which, you know, leading up to the Kiss Unplugged, how was that? How did he feel about that when it was happening? And then, once Ace and Peter joined them, and that it was starting to get worried at that point about that possible reunion that actually eventually did happen. And how was that, you know, playing with them for the first time, Ace and Peter, when they, you know, all got together? How did that all really, you know, pan out and go? And did he think after that was over that was going to be it? You know, was that really in his mind that he thought, oh no, that went too well. It's going to, you know, the response was too good. They're going to probably, you know, get to back together and tour again or what? You know, I would like to know that whole experience for him. I think that'd be really interesting.
Yet during the rehearsals for Unplugged, there was drama with the original two. There were power plays. They didn't show up. There was like a renegotiation that happened, which resulted in, I think it was Alex Kledd filling his Ace during one of the sound checks coming up to the show. So it'd be interesting to get Bruce's take on that. Was that like, did he enjoy that moment when Ace and Peter were kind of renegotiating, making a little bit of a power play through their manager in the middle of it, that he thought, oh, there's no way a reunion can work with those guys.
Right.
That sort of shit. I'm safe for now. Or was it, it's happening? That's a great one. Really like that. Mine is, I don't know if people are going to think this one's boring. I want to know more about Blackjack. Just how that band came together, its construction, its touring, its creative process with Michael Bolton, and also its end, more importantly, the second album and the touring for that. The band just kind of falls apart. Michael goes solo, and from my understanding, Bruce joins his solo band in 83 and goes out on the road with Michael, you know, going from being in a band with him to being in his band. So I'm very interested in that whole period leading up to his recruitment into Kiss, because he was doing session work with the like of Stevie, Rosetta, Stone, I think it was. He's doing a ton of stuff. The French Canadian Stevie album is really good, by the way.
Do we know how Bolton got in contact with Kiss in 89 when they wrote that Forever song? Did Bruce have anything to do with that?
I don't know. I can't remember the details, you know, on that. So maybe that would be in the book too. I mean, to put in a Kiss thing, I think mine would definitely be 1991. Not so much. And Sylvie, thank you for kind of going in a similar direction. I'm more interested in the rehearsals, the pre-production that they were doing, because they did do radio interviews from pre-production. I want to know exactly how much music was done with Eric Carr in 1991 around his recovery from surgery, whether they ever got to the stage where he was actively drumming in sessions for pre-production, and the arrangement of material that was later recorded, whether there were demos recorded with Eric Carr in 1991 for a prospective future expanded edition of Revenge. You know, and that kind of detail. I am less interested in the drama around Eric Carr's death and passing, and this, because I don't think he'll go there. I think he will keep the gloves on when it comes to certain matters that are very private and very hurtful. There's still a lot of wounds. So I'm more interested in 1991 musically from that perspective. Let's get into another board topic, and this one is by Janup17. How many great albums did Kiss actually make? And I'll just read his introduction because it sets the context quite well. The thread about 10,000 Volts being a great album made me wonder, how many great albums did Kiss make? Since I'm bored with Christmas and now going into New Year's, I quickly ranked all the Kiss albums, studio and live albums, that's something called Alive, into great, very good, good, neither bad. But let's just talk about great and how you define great when it comes to a Kiss album throughout your the years that you've been a fan. Has a great Kiss album changed? You know, from 40 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago? Well, I can't say 10. Daniel, what is a great Kiss album?
I think the one you were introduced the albums that introduced you to Kiss will always be special, but in hindsight you have to reevaluate them. And for me, Animal Eyes, for example, was a great album for years and years, but looking back at it, I can't claim that anymore. Asylum was another. That may still be there, up there. But then when I, went back and discovered the back catalog, I found a lot of albums that took some years for me to enjoy at the same level as I did the 80s albums. But as of now, I would say Rock and Roll Over is a solid, great album. Alive, of course, such a great live document. And I would probably go Destroyer as well. But other than that, Revenge, well, it has a few clonkers on there, so it doesn't make the great. It's not great, it's very good. And I don't think I can claim that any other albums are great, you know, from start to finish. Yeah, so let's see if Mark agrees with me and about Destroyer.
Well, let's go straight there, Mark.
Well, I mean, I think this is very subjective too. I mean, what people's tastes are, you know, as far as what is, and that's the thing too, what do you define great? Is great like the middle rung, or is great the top of the list, or what? Because I mean, some people might say excellent is better than great, right?
I forgot or one album, Creatures of the Night. I have to add Creatures of the Night before.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Thrash, Destroyer.
A great record, I think, is one that's, you know, decently recorded. More importantly, has songs that I enjoy listening to, you know, or can listen to from beginning to end. I mean, I think a superb album is one that has all those things that I like in a record. It sounds great. The songwriting is good. The performance is really good. You know, it kind of has a mood that I feel is really strong. That's why I'll always put Dynasty in as one of the greatest records, because I think that it has an overall feel to it. The performances are really well done on there. The songwriting is very strong, even though it is sort of like a, you know, there's one or two kind of disco-ish songs on there, but still the whole vibe of it is very New York City. I've always enjoyed that record. But if I'm going to talk about great records, you know, the first Kiss record, yes, it's slower and it doesn't have the same kind of, you know, production qualities as the later records, but that's one record where it's very rare that I'll ever skip anything, even, you know, Love Theme from Kiss. Luckily, it's short enough that it just kind of goes by quickly enough that it doesn't really bother my listening experience in that. So that's a good one. Dress to Kill definitely is a good record, too. I mean, or a great record. You know, it was recorded really well. It's a short record. you know, and you know, creatures I wouldn't put in the great. I would put it in like awesome, like above that, right? Because everything about that is 10 out of 10 in my opinion. Like that to me is an engineer's must have. Like when you start doing engineering school, they should put that record on, say, listen to this first before we get started on anything, so you know what a great record's supposed to sound like, you know. And that's what I think of that kind of tier, right? And then that tier is like Rock and Roll Over, Creatures of the Night, you know, Dynasty is up there for me as well, you know, those kind of records. And but then Asylum, which is one of my favorite records, I would put it maybe in a division one lower, because I don't think sonically it's as good, but those songs mean everything to me. The songwriting of them was fantastic. I think the recording of the vocals for Paul, I think that's one of his benchmark albums as far as vocals go. I think he did a great job. And being a sole producer on that record, I got to tip my hat. He's a great producer. He just maybe needed a little bit more guidance on some of the tones on that. But, you know, it was also an 80s period. So there was a lot of things that were popular in that era to do. And he was pretty aware of that, I think, at the time. So that's kind of how I divide it. I know it's kind of a long-winded answer, but that's how I kind of look at it.
We're podcasters. We do long-winded answers.
Except notice how I skipped over Destroyer altogether.
Well, yeah, because you've erased that from your psyche.
Yeah, it's at the bottom. So
yeah. I think about half of them are great. At least. I thought, well, yeah, great. And then there's what I would call like masterpiece kind of thing. and that's a real rarity, but just going through them. I mean, really the whole 70s era, let's skip the solo albums for now, but all that, everything in the 70s, I think is great. First three albums, The Alive, Destroyer, Rock and Roll Over, Love Gun, Alive 2, Dynasty, all that stuff is, to me, great. I love it all. Sure, there's some songs, you know, sketchy songs on an album here and there, but the overall greatness of the other songs, you know, on the album that appeared really did make those albums really great. Just the whole thing, the vibe and everything. So then after that, then you start tailing off a little bit, but, you know, definitely Creatures and Lick It Up for me are great, and Revenge. And then after that, I don't know what's, you know, great. There's good for me. Then you get down to good and stuff like that. So, but even, you know, I'm borderline on The Elder. I mean, is it great? And I like it a lot, but I have to put it, it's good. It's good. But that sort of thing. So anyway, definitely the 70s. Everything is just so darn, you know, it's good. It's great. Like all of those albums, I can listen to any of them at any time and enjoy every one of them. No problem.
I think you have to hand it to The Elder or the efforts that went into The Elder. The last time they tried to do something from left field, tried to do something to surprise the audience. After that, they always looked on what was popular and tried to mimic that.
Yep. Exactly.
There's a great thread on the FAQ about The Elder today. It's the snapping section.
Why is there no solo there? I always thought
It's that snapping, finger snapping section there because Ace didn't do a solo for it. I don't think so. It wasn't addressed in the Odyssey book for anyone thinking.
I think it was more, you know, I saw that and I was thinking about that. And I thought maybe they already were thinking about something else was going on during that because they were thinking of it's going to be a movie and they want this section to be some kind of, you know, I don't know, where all the people are getting together and they're and, you know, all the characters on there are getting into it or something going on. Or, you know, they could do a snap scene during a big fight scene, you know, it's like how they try to be real arty.
In vogue. Aerosmith was doing it the next year with Lightning Strikes video. Mm-hmm. They were doing the kind of...
Oh, man, that video.
Oh, that's a great video.
Snaps are... were in style at the time.
No, I think that snap happened organically just because Eric Carr didn't drum on that because he couldn't get the swing, allegedly. So they brought in Schwartz.
Swing, they could have brought in Peter Criss.
Yeah, swing. So I think it naturally develops from that swing and kind of the attitude of it. But it's certainly not a space where you could stick a solo over, that's for certain. So I don't think it has anything to do with that.
Yeah, okay, back to... Hold on, McMurphy says...
Oh no.
Matt McMurphy says.
Very Grease. Yeah, exactly. While we wait for Ken to rejoin, what is a great Kiss album? It changes for me on a day-to-day basis, really. But for the most part, a great Kiss album is going to be one that is guaranteed to affect my mood. One that I reach for when I'm bummed out, overworked, or stressed out, that's guaranteed to be that medicine. You know, if I'm going to call out the doctor, literally it's going to be Rock and Roll Over is a great Kiss album. The First album is a great Kiss album. Creatures of the Night is a great Kiss album. And that might be where my list ends. You know, I'm with Mark on Asylum. You know, while that has an emotional connection to me, I'm not going to ever call it a great album because it's got some Gene Simmons mid-80s songs on it.
I love
the
them.
Image. Yeah, I like them too, but I'm not going to call them great. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say that they make the album greater. Lick It Up is, you know, a really good album, but I'm not going to say it's as great as Creatures of the Night. Hotter Than Hell is a really good album, but it's not as great as the debut. Even though it's got some really good songs on it. So, you know, a great album shifts. It's not about its performance on the charts. It's not about its sales. It's just how does it come together as a package and how does it affect me or afflict me? Going to the other side of the coin, going to Mark's destroyer side of the coin.
I think you touched on something really interesting there when you said an album you can go to when you're feeling down. I'm sure we all had terrible things happen in our lives. And I remember one thing that happened to me that was really awful. And I, you know, I took my car and just drove. And then I reached for a record. What do I want to listen to? Asylum. Yeah. I remember listening to that when, you know, going through one of those, you know, hardships that we all have to go through as human beings.
Yeah, that's your emotional support Kiss album. You know, and I would say similarly for me, because that takes me back to a very happy place. I'll throw on that. It was that weekend 40 years ago, basically, that I bought Theater of Pain and Asylum, and that started me on my journey. It takes me back to a very happy time for me as a music fan. So, yeah, you know, but it's not a great album. It's a great emotional support album for Mr. Gill or for Mr. Wheeze. All right, let's move on to the next topic. Ken, you going to stick around this time or are you going to get angry and leave?
I don't know what happened. I clicked myself out of the darn...
Yes. Anyway. You got StreamYarded. All right, Ken, this is going to be a great one for you. What would your 13-year-old self think of modern Kiss merch? So it may not be 13 when you became a fan, but, you know, what would you in your
modern Kiss merch?
Yeah. Well, back what then? Do you think about where Kiss went with its Spencer's crap? And worse.
You know, anything back then when I was, you know, at least younger, and I remember originally buying the, you know, the Kiss dolls and the trash can, the guitar and all that stuff back then, you know, anything, you're trying to get anything you that you could Kiss at the time. But what I would think about that, some of it is like, I guess I would think on some of it like that, some of the Spencer stuff where they have some those weird designs of the little figures, action figures, is like, you know, what are they going for here on this? But otherwise, yeah, I'm okay. I'd be okay with it if I was young. You know, it's all... You know, each person's gonna like some of it and not like some of it. Do I want Hello Kitty toilet paper? No.
13-year-old, have you
but,
wanted it? Yeah, but if, yeah, what about
a 13-year-old? Yeah, me, a 13-year-old, I wouldn't have wanted that. I wouldn't have been into that. Now, if it was not Hill, it was Batman, maybe I would have, you know? Something like that, yeah. Related to Kiss, some kind of like that thing. So it's all depending on what you like. And I definitely would like that, you know, the vinyl releases and some of the t-shirts that they're, you know, been releasing. Reproduction, obviously, I'm still liking it, obviously. I buy that stuff. So, yeah, I'm okay. Some of the stuff is just, you know, a kid is thinking like a Kiss coffin. I wouldn't have been interested in that, you know, because when you're that young, you're not thinking of, you know, even thinking from about that kind of stuff at all. You thought, I have my whole life to live. What do I need a Kiss coffin for? So, yeah, stuff beer like cooler. That. What?
Don't forget, it also functioned as a beer cooler.
Yeah. That's true, but when I was 13, I wasn't drinking beer either.
But very tacky for me at 13 is the same as me now, in many ways. I never gave a shit about the merch. I was very particular about what I bought. It was usually vinyl. It was usually rare collectibles, you know, like my story about getting the Japanese Oath single so that I could hear the B-side, you know, and hear stuff. You know, it was the very occasional magazine, like the Kiss Exposed or the Kiss on Tour, the Rocks, I think it was Roxine, did those back in the 80s, the VHSs. I never bought jock keys. I've been very selective in the stuff that I purchased over the years. I've snorted and laughed with derision at most of the merchandise issued over the last 30 years, you know, $650 leather jackets. I'm like, I could buy a record or six for that, you know. So my attitude towards merchandise is probably one of the few areas in which I'm consistent in my life. I didn't give a shit about it back then. I don't give a shit about it now. I don't mind seeing it. It's always nice to see and not have to pay for the privilege of seeing it. Daniel.
Well, I guess you're a child of the times you grew up in. Child in time. That's a great song. Well, however, when I was 13, I don't think I even was aware of all the Kiss merchandise. What I was looking for was, of course, music. So the soundboards, for example, I would have bought them when I was a kid. Soundboards would have been, what's that? Julian's holding up. Ah, what's that called in English?
Sylvie mentioned a snow globe. This is the one from the cruise. So I'm not completely consistent because I didn't go out and buy that and didn't go on the cruise.
Nice.
No, so merchandise was never a thing, but the music, the soundboards I would get, t-shirts. I was into t-shirts. I can still recall the first t-shirt I bought from OK Magazine. It was a picture of Gene and Paul and no one else on the t-shirt. I remember it was a shot from Lick It Up, I think, and it was sort of cartoonish looking. I still like that picture to this day. So I would probably have gone for the t-shirts and the soundboards. And of course, I was also into reading about Kiss. So I would have gotten that book they released, but that's almost 10 years ago now, the Ken Sharp book there. What's it called?
Nothing to Lose.
Yeah, I would have gotten that as well. So books, and of course magazines, if they released some sort of magazines, Kiss magazines. You know, I was heavily into the circuit with the fan magazines that were popular in the early 90s, like Strike magazine and all that stuff, Firehouse magazine, Kiss Hell, I think I had for a while as well.
Yeah.
Anything in print, any audio and posters and t-shirts, I would have gone for that.
Right. So you don't need the plushies. You don't need the Kiss telephone. You don't
need the
neon. No. Again, and there's nothing wrong if you do like that stuff. No. Mark.
Yeah, the 13-year-old me is probably the same as the me now. I mean, I've never been very big on the whole merch end of things. I mean, yeah, I have like when Spencer's came out, when it first started getting popular, it was right around the time I started getting back heavily into collecting vinyl. It was my resurgence into collecting vinyl. And of course, with that came a resurgence in collecting Kiss records. Like, there was a one point I can vividly remember where I was getting the mailman coming to my house every day for almost like 4 weeks straight, getting me Kiss records. I'd buy off Discogs or whatever. And I was getting records all the time. People thought I was nuts getting all these records, you know, which why I ended up having like, you know, 17 copies of Rock and Roll Over, 12 copies of Unmasked, and all these. I had like a vast collection of records, and that was where my heart was and where my interests were. But, you know, when Spencer opened, I would go to my mall every once in a while. You'd see these Kiss things in there, and every once in a blue moon I'd grab something. Like, I have like a Kiss Christmas ornament for the Christmas tree. Or I got that, I think for Christmas one year, my sister got me that that incense thing with the heads where the smoke comes out of Jean's mouth, right? And those things were given to me as gifts. I never bought them myself. But I was always more about the music stuff. And much like Daniel, I was very much a magazines guy. I was used to always buy, you know, Hit Parade or Circus magazine, even back then, like 10, 11, 12, because my sister was such a big influence on me musically. She used to, you know, buy all these kind of magazines too. She would buy like the Tiger Beat and all those other things, but I would buy like Hit Parade and those other magazines. And I just loved it. I would just dive into it because as we all well know, back in those days, back when we were younger, there was no internet. So a lot of our information came through magazines and pictures and stuff like that from magazines. We got to see what was going on with the band, right? So 13-year-old me was very much about the records and stuff like that. And it's funny because that's also kind of translated into my own sort of thing, because I get messages constantly from people who are support Project Gemini and saying, why don't you make some new t-shirts? Why don't you make some this? Or why don't you make that? And why don't you do this and that? And I'm like, I'm not opposed to doing it. I did do it in the past. I made the coffee mugs and stuff like that, but it's just not really where my heart is. And it kind of translates to that. Then maybe that's a mistake, because some people say that, you know, if you were to do that, well, I would buy the mugs and I would buy this and that. And maybe I'm, you know, avoiding an extra stream of money that could be beneficial, but it just never was something that was in the forefront of my musical interest. Me, it was mainly the music and I liked the magazines.
Yeah. So it seems we really haven't changed. No one turned into a massive Spencer's fan. All right, let's go into another. And Gene made this comment. I need to check out where it came from. But he said, Gene said, in a very strange way, Kiss became a very big band without hit songs. Duh. Water is wet. Gymnasium. Next topic. it is kind of true that, you know, when you compare Kiss with like an Aerosmith, multiple multi-platinum albums, Grammys, hit singles, all over the place, Kiss was never that band. You know, they had maybe two or three singles, I guess. Rock and Roll All Night did a little bit of something. Beth, I Was Made for Loving You. Other than that, they weren't putting out singles that got much attention on a regular basis. In the other outliers, like God Gave Rock and Roll to You and Forever.
Calling Dr. Love.
The paper single, Rocket Ride. Well, that was Paola. But Daniel, would you agree that they're not a singles band, but they're still a big band in that sense?
Well, I think it was all about the experience, the Kiss experience. The bombs, the makeup, the show. That was what the band was famous for. And music, for most people, came secondly. That was maybe not the case with all the other big classic rock groups. Music played a bigger part in their in their cases. I'd say the show was so mind-blowing and the characters were so well thought out, even though they weren't, they worked perfectly. So I'd say the whole Kiss experience blew people's mind and made them a great band. And even though they made a lot of great tunes through the years,
it really didn't translate into the public. Sort of people were more into, well, what do you know about Kiss? Well, it's that guy with the tongue and they have a lot of explosions. I guess that's the general opinion about Kiss, and I think it was kind of true. So that's my take on it.
Yeah, and I just happen to have this quote open from something I'm working on right now, and it's it kind of sums it all up for me. And it says, the reason I don't notice these defects, that, and it's a review, that the show doesn't have a lot of great songs and stuff, is that Kiss compensate for them with a huge energy and evangelical belief in their own rock supremacy.
I think the closest thing nowadays is probably that German band, Rammstein. I watched a show, I think it was a year or two back in Gothenburg, and it was completely mind-blowing. I knew a few of their songs. I don't speak German that well, so I didn't understand what they were talking about, but I still had a great time. And I guess it was much the same case back in the 70s when you went to watch Kiss. It was the wildest thing you could go and watch. And even though you didn't know the music, you could still have a great time.
Du hast?
Du hast. You hate, I think it means. You hate.
Rammstein is just a fantastic band. You don't have to speak Sprachese Deutsch in order to understand the vibe. It's got the riffs, it's got the hooks, and just like Kiss, it's got shit blowing up in the right places and a stage. For non-German speakers, it's the same thing, I guess, that a show can envelop you with energy and attitude without understanding a fucking word of what's going on.
It was actually pretty scary to be at that show because fire went out and explosions everywhere, and it was sort of being a part of, you know, being a soldier in the Second World War or something. remember they played two nights in Gothenburg. The first night I didn't have tickets, so I just went outside and watched, and you could see, you know, like black smoke coming out of the stadium and totally black in the sky. So I was really excited for the next evening. It was one of the best shows I've seen.
Yeah, you should see some of the widescreen photos of their whole pyro thing going off as well. It's like, this is inspired by Kiss. This is inspired by, you know, bands like Queen in the 70s with their massive stage productions.
Yeah.
You know, and there were some others with impressive, well, Floyd as well, in terms of the theatrical elements, and Bowie. All of this is now distilled down to that. What the fuck were we talking about? Yeah, Mark, in a strange way, Kiss became a very big band without hit songs.
Well, I mean, it's not that they didn't try. I mean, all we have to do is look back at the Casablanca singles box that came out, where they released all the singles that they put out over the years. They tried. They tried, like you mentioned earlier, the Payola route. They tried Legitimate Roots, and some of it stuck, some of it didn't. Like you said, three of them were the only real main hit singles they had. You know, and I remember reading all that story about Calling Dr. Love, how they tried to push that to become a big single, which it never did. But I think it made top 40, I think. But, you know, it's interesting that I also find Rocker reading a lot of these books and going through it again when you reread some of these books, that some of their popularity is perception too. I mean, you know, you think about something like the Cadillac Michigan thing when they played in Cadillac, and they are in the football stadium hanging out with all the kids, and it's a big brouhaha, and then all of a sudden this helicopter comes in to pick them up, and they jump in and they're waving goodbye and leaving these flyers, and then they have to drop the helicopter like 2 seconds after they leave the building on the other side because they can't afford to go any further than beyond the stadium because they were so broke. So, but nobody, of course, knew that happened. So the perception of, wow, these guys got picked up with a helicopter, flew them all the way back. So, you know, a lot of the times they were pulling the wool over your eyes with how popular they actually were, how big and mighty they actually were in the early days. You know, I think a lot of it was that. I think McCoy did a great job of making them appear more popular than they actually were at the time, you know. But a lot of it was about the show. But even in the early days, a lot of the show was, you know, duct tape and wiring. A lot of it, you know, sometimes things would fall apart, or, you know, that their stuff was never 100% perfectly done until much later. Once they actually started making money and having money that they can put properly towards it, then the shows became much more, you know, professional looking and much more, you know, well, less prone to error. Let's just put it that way. All right. But in the early days, I mean, they were flying by the seat of their pants. So, I mean, it's the same thing with the singles. You know, I mean, they tried to make their singles seem like they were these huge things and tried to do it in any route that they could with the payola or whatever, or even say, you know, this song's doing really well here and there, and maybe it even wasn't. So, but in the end, they got where they wanted to get to, I would think.
I think the smoke and mirrors, the stage show, the magic show is what it's always been about, that all of that was used. But they had the songs, they had the material, but by presenting it in such a way that turned them into what was called the hype, you know, made it seem like they didn't have musical substance. Therefore, the John Warners, Wenners, you know, refused to take them seriously and actually listen to them. You know, Kiss have said people listen with their eyes. And I think that works both ways, that because of their image, because of the flash, the explosions, the levitating drum kits, you know, people could see the wires and people were still commenting on it up into the reunion and beyond. You know, when Ace would shoot the rockets up at the Lighting Trust, they thought that was real. You know, he missed with his rocket and something fell down, you know, but yet they could see Gene flying with his wires and you suspend belief. But I think by suspending belief, it never gave them the opportunity to actually present those songs until Beth got through the censors.
I think great example of that train of thought is Wasp. You know, took quite a few years before I really understood the greatness in the music, because it was all about Blackie Lawless throwing meat at the audience and, you know, raping
nuns
with knives and stuff. So it's not only Kiss that has played this game. I think Wasp is an even better example, where the music is kind of hidden behind this masquerade.
Yeah, the shock gets in the way of the music sometimes. And I think it happened with the Pistols as well, because if you listen to that album, never mind the Bollocks, solid album, but I think the punk fury, you know, and Bill Grundy again poison people. AB, great comments, you know, the press bought it and warned the parents, and the parents became the mothers against the music of Kiss. Ken,
I had actually responded on that thread, and I had a quote, I think it was that I found about In the United States, the United Kingdom, a single is usually considered a hit when it reaches the top 40 of the Billboard Hot 100 or the top 75 of the UK singles chart. So they called that a hit. And though to me, a real hit would have been like if Kiss had a number one. If Kiss had a number one, that would have made a huge difference.
Or top 10.
They had, well, they had top tens.
Not a lot, but a couple.
One or two, right? So, according to...
Nothing Forever.
According to Billboard, it had also... Here, I actually have some of them here. Like, Rock and Roll Night Live was 12 on the charts.
I was made 11, Beth, I think.
Beth was 7. Hard Luck Woman was number 15. Calling Dr. Love was 16.
See, Christine's, they're still out of that, you know? Like,
yeah, Christine 16 was 25.
Calling Dr. Love was number 2 in Canada.
Woo-hoo. There you go. I Was Made for Loving You, it says 11. What else is in the top 40 here? I think there was nine songs that made the top 40. Forever was at number 8.
Yeah, I Was Made for Loving You only hit number 11, but it was still a good single back in the day.
Yeah, but what I think is Gene is correct. They weren't, you know. A real hit is if you hit number one, you're set pretty much for life, I think. Just having one number one hit, it somehow does something. So that's why the other thing about the music, I think unfortunately the theatrics overtook the music to a degree, so it wasn't focused enough on how good that music was. You know, again, we've talked about it before, and I've said it before. If the music sucked, there's no way they would have made it. They had to have that background of really great music in order to do it. You can't have that great show and be a bunch of, you know, a bunch of crap songs. It just wouldn't have worked. It wouldn't have lasted at all. It's just no way. So now the music is the backbone of the whole thing.
I think yeah, Silver Rose was about a great show.
Yeah. But yeah. Silver Rose touched on something really important. I think the only hit that will, you know, mean something in the future is I Was Made for Loving You. That's the only global hit they had. And you have just to look at Spotify. I think it reached a billion views last year. So,
yeah, Daniel, you bring up that. I just watched that movie, The Fall Guy, right? The two nights ago. And that I Was Made for Loving You was so prominent in that whole movie, whether it's Kiss's version a number of times in the movie, plus other versions or background music, instrumental versions of I Was Made for Loving You. It was amazing to me. I was like, I kept hearing, you know, the song come up, and it was like, wow, I never seen Kiss get so much, you know, the music of Kiss get, you know, so much play in a movie, just one song, but it's just like all different versions, and it's like, wow, I think that's what catapulted this year, that song, to go up, you know, over a billion, because people saw the movie and they heard the song, a lot of people probably for the first time, and I think that really pushed it over the top.
Yeah, I mean, who's to know? They weren't relying on radio play because they weren't getting it, and I think that's why they became a big band despite a lack of hits. You know, other bands relied on longevity on the charts, singles, and really pushed singles. I mean, you know, Aerosmith went the way of re-releasing songs that they felt hadn't gotten their due. You know, Kiss tried that once. You know, and it didn't work on that level of, say, Dream On or Walk This Way, both of which took two goes to, you know, really, really work. So, yeah, Gene is right, but people, again, were talking about the show more so than the music after seeing them. They were looking forward to seeing it. You've got to see this, not you've got to hear this. You've got to see this. Mm-hmm. Whereas you go to an Aerosmith show in the 70s and you can barely see them on the stage and they're not blowing shit up, but they're just standing there. There's a whole different thing. You're going to hear the music for that. Mm-hmm. You know, Nugent, you're going to see him for the music and his antics. You know, so
yeah.
All right, that's a whole bunch of good topics for today. That's enough. I'm gonna go have a nap since I've been up so long. You know, what do you think about these topics that we've talked about today? You know, chime in wherever you listen to this, and if you want to have your thoughts included in the 10th anniversary show, which will be coming up on the 18th of January, we would love to include them. We'd very much appreciate it, as much as we appreciate you listening to us every week. We'd love to be able to include some of the listener thoughts on the show as we pass that decade mark. So check out on the KISS FAQ message board. I will put up a post of where you can submit or how you can submit. And I may do a couple of open recording sessions for people who are challenged, just so that I can record you for you and take the onus off you. Yes. All right, that's it for this week. Lonnie, hope you're feeling better. So from Ken, Mark, Daniel, and myself, thanks for joining us, and we shall see you next time. Thank you for spending time listening to the KISS FAQ podcast today. All sales are final. There are no refunds. If you'd like, look us up on Facebook or come over to the KISS FAQ message board and discuss the topic we've broadcast today. Don't forget to rate us on iTunes, Spreaker, or wherever you've listened to the show. We hope you'll join us again.